you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, May Martinez. Still need to get your flu shot, but worried about going to a doctor's office? Well, it's easier and safer than you might think. Plus, you'll be helping ease the burden on local hospitals. Plus, yeah, I know, we've all been here twice before. The Dodgers only 4 wins away from a championship. We'll hear why this time your blue bleeding heart will not be broken. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm E. Martinez. Coming up.
This time he hits the ball to deep right field. Cody Bellinger has done it! And the Dodgers lead in Game 7.
Yeah, the Dodgers are going to the World Series, but can they go all the way this time? Lots of questions. We'll get into those just ahead. But first, have you gotten your flu shot yet? The flu season is going to look different this year, especially here in LA County, where we have had the most confirmed COVID cases and deaths of any county in the U.S. Now, that's made many people reluctant to visit a doctor's office and made public health officials worry that people will shy away from getting those flu shots. Jackie Fortier is KPCC's health reporter, and she's been covering this story. Okay, so Jackie, why is it important to get a flu shot this year, maybe more than in years past?
Well, this is the first cold and flu season in the U.S. to overlap with the coronavirus. We may be waiting for a vaccine for COVID-19, but we already have one for the flu, and that is really good news. So you should get a flu shot because it protects you from catching the flu and spreading it to others, which may help lessen the burden on hospitals and medical staff. And it's also something you can do. You know, a lot of people feel really helpless right now, but getting a flu shot is a safe and easy thing that you can do to protect your health and your family.
I like that. Taking control. At least it is something you can do. All right. So Jackie, How do I find out where I can get a flu shot?
Yeah, the website vaccinefinder.org lets you find locations for all immunizations anywhere in the country. Vaccinefinder.org will show you which pharmacies, grocery stores with pharmacies in them, urgent care centers, medical clinics are offering flu shots. You should call ahead to make sure your local pharmacy has the flu shot before you show up. CVS and Walgreens are offering online scheduling for flu shots. 11 LA County libraries are offering free flu shot clinics on specific days now through November. Some locations even have drive-through options. And then several city health clinics are offering free flu vaccinations at certain times of the week. So check out their websites.
Now, Jackie, when my wife got her shot last week, they gave her a stronger version. She's older. She's also got a compromised immune system. I was not able to get that same shot. What's the difference between the two shots?
Well, good job to your wife for getting her flu shot.
Me too. I got one too.
Me too. Okay, good job. Gold star. Right. There's a few different options for the flu shot, and it's kind of changed over the years. Since 2010, now we have more options. So there's the standard vaccine for people over the age of 18, and there's alternatives for children depending on their age. Seniors over the age of 65, it's designed to deliver a stronger immune response. For people who don't like needles, there's the nasal spray. There's an egg-free variant for people with egg allergies.
Yeah.
The CDC really recommends that anyone over the age of 6 months get a flu shot, including pregnant women. That's very important. But really, getting the flu shot this season is the important thing. If you have any questions about which one to get, just talk to your doctor.
All right. So some places give them for free, but what do they cost in other places?
Yeah, so flu shots are required to be provided at no cost under the Affordable Care Act, though you may need to reach out to your health insurance company directly to find out if you need to go to like a specific provider or location to get the shot for free. So for example, if you have Kaiser as your health insurer, you might need to go to a Kaiser site to get the shot for free. If you're insured by Medi-Cal, you can find a primary care doctor by calling the General County Helpline, which is 211, and flu shots are free under Medi-Cal.
All right, Jackie, the million-dollar question, how effective is this season's flu shot?
I wish I could tell. It's too early to know how effective it will be. But even if you catch the flu, having gotten the shot can really lessen the disease's length and severity. And if you've ever had the flu, you want it to last the limited amount of time possible. Australia and other Southern Hemisphere countries just finished a record low flu season. And experts say that's happened for a few reasons. People got vaccinated, they wore masks, and they physically distanced. We also know that flu shots work. Last season, the vaccine kept 4 million Americans from getting sick and 3,500 from dying, according to the CDC. It is also possible for people to get the flu and COVID at the same time. Now, getting a flu shot will not prevent COVID, of course, but it could help your doctors differentiate between the diseases if you develop any symptoms like fever, cough, sore throat that they share. Again, you cannot get the flu from the flu vaccine. And then from like a broader public health perspective, if enough of the U.S. population gets vaccinated, it could really help head off what could be a nightmare scenario in the coming winter of hospitals who are, you know, just stuffed with both COVID-19 patients and people who have severe flu. So you can do something about it. You can go get your flu shot.
That's KPCC's health reporter, Jackie Fortier. Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, moving on now to a nearby toxic waste site that is now in the hands of California. Last Friday, a bankruptcy court ruled that Exide Technologies can abandon its closed-down battery recycling plant in Vernon. The company would leave behind a massive prolonged toxic cleanup effort, an effort that will now largely fall to the state and all of us taxpayers. For many, the Exide plant has become a symbol of environmental injustice decades in the making. State officials say the plant spewed lead dust around the area for years and remains a dangerous source of lead, arsenic, and other toxic pollutants. The effects of these pollutants have disproportionately fallen on the predominantly working-class Latino communities around the plant in southeast Los Angeles. So, what is the future of the Exide plant cleanup? Where do these communities go from here? And how can we prevent more toxic spills in California? With us to discuss all of this is UCLA's law professor Sean Hecht, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. Professor, so tell us about the bankruptcy ruling first. What did the judge end up deciding and what went into that decision?
Yes, nice to be with you today, A. The bankruptcy court announced his intention to confirm the bankruptcy plan for Exide Technologies. Basically, the company is going to liquidate. It has liabilities and debts that exceed its assets, and the judge said that the court is going to approve the plan, and that plan will involve Exide essentially being able to walk away from the plant that it has operated for decades in Vernon, California, a property that right now is in the midst of a pretty massive closure and cleanup effort, and that leaves the site really without any obvious future site management and funding other than what the state is able to provide.
Professor, how is it that Exide comes away from all of this without any responsibility for this, just gets to walk away? Can you explain some of the history of this bankruptcy case that got us to where we are now?
Yes. Well, so Exide operated this plant for decades at this location, and due to a number of different failures in our permitting and enforcement system, they were allowed to operate in ways that were very harmful to the public health of communities around them. The firm has actually been in bankruptcy twice before, and after coming out of those bankruptcies, they kept having to work to clean up the site after it was closed. And there has been a fair amount of resources devoted by the company, but not nearly enough to make up for the harm that they've created. But now this bankruptcy proceeding is a liquidation, and so that means that at the end of the line, there's only going to be so much funding to go around, and the bankruptcy judge has to make decisions about where that money will be allocated and how. And the proposal that that the facility and its other creditors came up with would have given just a paltry amount to dedicate to cleanup with the state. So the state rejected it, and the consequence of that is that the bankruptcy court is going to allow them to abandon the site. It's one of the oddities of our bankruptcy system is it allows environmental cleanup liabilities in some cases to go completely unfunded.
So, Professor, if someone has a claim against a company, what happens to that claim? What happens to the people making the claim?
So it depends on the circumstances. The first in line in a bankruptcy when there isn't enough funding to go around, and especially in a liquidation where there's not going to be future revenue for the company, the first in line are going to be the secured creditors of the company. Anybody who the company owed a specific amount of money to under a contract or an agreement, that had some sort of secured liability associated with it. And unfortunately, environmental liabilities are in many cases not anywhere near the front of the line in cases like this. Again, especially in a situation where the company is going to be liquidated. But everybody has to file claims in the bankruptcy proceeding and assert, whatever interests or rights they have. And the bankruptcy judge has a lot of discretion to make determinations about the best outcome. Unfortunately, when a company goes out of business, there isn't a future revenue stream, and so there's not going to be enough money to go around. And the question then is, what do you prioritize? And unfortunately, in bankruptcy court, this is not being prioritized.
Talking to UCLA law professor Sean Hecht, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. In his ruling, Professor, the judge said that the Exide plant does not pose an imminent, immediate harm to the public. Can you give us a sense of the situation as it stands right now? What's the state of the Exide plant, and what is the risk to the area?
Yes, well, I think, I'm not an expert on the science, but my understanding is that there's quite a bit of harm that's being done when the facility, even after closure of the facility, some of which is in the neighborhood where people's properties have been contaminated, but also the site itself right now is enclosed and it has to be maintained in very specific ways in order to ensure that the contamination, doesn't get out. I mean, the remarks as quoted in the Los Angeles Times, which was my source for this, I found pretty remarkable. The idea that, the judge basically said, there's lead everywhere, it's a problem we all have. We all have lead in our systems. How can lead be an imminent threat? Well, new exposure to lead is a threat, and uncontrolled exposure to lead is a particular threat. And so I think, to me, it seems to be a misunderstanding of what an imminent endangerment is, to say that such a potent toxin as lead couldn't pose an imminent threat just because there's so much of it already out there in the community.
Prolonged exposure to lead. I mean, just as a quick baseline, what does that do? What are the potential ramifications of that?
Well, I'm certainly not a medical expert or a scientist, but it's a neurotoxin. It affects the development of children. It affects, in many ways, people's can affect people's mental capacity over time. Can create all kinds of effects. People have linked scientists have linked even pretty low levels of chronic lead exposure to demonstrable changes in people's neural capabilities. There's even studies that have linked lead contamination to increased antisocial activity in some cases, but there's no question that that science has shown that at very relatively low levels in people's blood, that lead poses a harm, and that lead is disproportionately in low-income communities and communities of color.
It's also on that, because we're talking about the Exide plant, that means we're talking about years of toxic pollution in communities like Boyle Heights, East LA, Maywood. Thinking about this from the standpoint of environmental justice, why was Exide able to operate this plant for so long in these areas with no consequences, seemingly?
Yes, well, so environmental injustice is everywhere. There's no question that public health harms from contamination and from air pollution are mostly visited upon low-income communities and communities of color. We have a history of land use decisions that have made that happen. In that situation in particular, the city of Vernon is almost exclusively industrial. It's a city that's really dedicated to housing heavy industry and has been since its inception. And it's right across the fence line from some very dense low-income residential communities. And so Exide is not the only facility in Vernon that has contributed to these problems. But we do have a history of these types of facilities being located in areas like that. They're the only other operating secondary lead smelting plant, which is the business Exide was in, is also in an area where it affects similar types of communities. And we have similar dynamics near the Port of Los Angeles, where communities like Wilmington are sandwiched between oil refineries and other heavy industry. So it's a very common kind of problem. And, you know, we don't see these facilities at the border of Beverly Hills.
No, we don't. Professor, some environmentalists have said that a long-term solution to these cleanups must include reforming the State Department of Toxic Substances Control. Governor Gavin Newsom just vetoed a bill that would have done that. What's the argument to reform the department, and does this argument have merit?
Yeah, so there's very strong arguments for reforming the department. The department over time has shown itself in some cases it does a decent job of regulating facilities that handle hazardous waste and dealing with toxics. Overall, it's been beset by problems for many years now. They do not prioritize effectively the sites that are the most contaminated, and many people think it's just a chronic set of structural problems that also is related to the underfunding of the agency. So in Exide's case, there were years of problems that were not properly enforced before the department finally decided to take action. There was an independent review commission a couple years ago that made some reform proposals. The bill that was put on the governor's desk this year would have been a good start. The veto, I'm not sure what to make of the veto. Part of it was because of a situation where certain types of revenue raising have to be passed by a two-thirds vote in order, because they're legally considered a tax. And the governor referenced that and said, well, you need to do this right and, you know, create ways of raising enough revenue by passing the right bill with a two-thirds vote. It strikes me that that shouldn't stand in the way of these structural reforms, but, the governor made the decision that he made. But there's no question that there are changes necessary in the way that the agency works, the way it's responsive to community needs and prioritizes. But it also just needs more money.
Looking ahead, what do you think comes next? What's the outlook for the Exide plant cleanup and others like it across the state?
Well, I wish I were more optimistic about this. The state has put a lot of money into it already. I mean, this cleanup is, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And unfortunately, there isn't the money available for it. One thing that the state could do and should do and has been doing a little bit more is requiring facilities at the beginning to plan financially for the eventual cleanup that will have to happen at them, and also to enforce the laws more strictly so we don't have toxic sites like this. But with Exide in particular, there's a few things happening. There's a fee that was passed a few years ago that when someone buys a lead-acid car battery, there's money contributed to a fund that can be used to clean up these sites. And there are other sources of money that can be used, but it's going to be a long road for it to be adequate to address the cleanup. And we see that in the community, in the community's widespread opposition to this bankruptcy discharge, where the community, every single person from the community who turned out said, you're just leaving us without a solution here. And unfortunately, that is true until we have a way of getting the funding. It's going to have to be both the companies and also the public that end up funding this, unfortunately.
That's UCLA Law Professor Sean Hecht, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
All right, for a long time, Orange County was a GOP stronghold, the home of President Richard Nixon and a place Ronald Reagan described as the place all good Republicans go to die. Things started to change a bit in the 90s, culminating with the 2018 midterms when Democrats took control of all seven congressional seats. Now, while it's fair to say that Orange County went from red to at least purple, there is a strong shade of blue starting to emerge just ahead of Election Day. Find out all about it when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
I'm just an Orange County girl, living in an extraordinary world. I'm just an Orange County girl, living in an extraordinary world. Sing.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Turn our attention now south to Orange County, where Orange County isn't red hot, but blue hot. That's at least according to early returns, plus a guide to some of the tightest races in the once famously conservative area of Southern California. Joining us, as always, Nick Gerda, reporter at the nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC. Nick, so let's start with the huge surge in voter turnout in Orange County. What do the numbers show us right now?
Yeah, we're seeing a really massive early participation by voters in this election. There was a whopping 451% increase in early ballots cast during the first 5 days of mail-in voting when you compare it with the same time frame in 2016. And those early ballots in OC are leaning heavily Democrat, about 70%. More Democrats have cast ballots than Republicans at this point. That makes less of a difference in city council and school board races where candidates' parties are not listed on the ballot. But for Congress and state legislature positions, parties are listed, and that does have more of an effect. Part of the surge in early voting is because of the pandemic. Everyone's getting a ballot, every registered voter. And there's a lot of concerns about possible delays with the Postal Service. So a lot of people are getting their ballots in early on. And as my colleague Brandon Foe reported, this election in particular is motivating a lot of voters to participate early. A lot of people are connecting the dots with how the election affects a lot of issues they care about, whether it's the pandemic, the economy, immigration, et cetera.
Now, people voting Democratic generally turn out more in presidential election years. So other than the volume of the turnout, Nick, is what we're seeing any different in other ways?
Yeah, we're really seeing a flip of the usual dynamic of who votes early. So that's something that's been noted by a lot of the early votes leaned Republican, with Democrats often waiting closer to election day to vote. This time it's the opposite, 163,000 Democrat ballots so far and 96,000 Republican ballots. And about 71,000 are from people with no party preference. So there's always that X factor about which way those voters will go. And it's worth noting all of these dynamics could change between now and election day. So nothing is set in stone. But the typical dynamic we've seen in the past is the first election results on election night tend to be more of reflecting the Republican vote. And then as more ballots are counted in the coming days, it shifts to be more Democrat. It could be a flipping of that dynamic this year, so something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and that's what you said. You dipped out a little bit on your line there, and that's what you said. The early votes lean Republican, Democrats waiting closer to Election Day, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
Now, yeah. Now, last week, Republican Party officials in the state got nationwide attention for setting up a supposed ballot drop boxes marked as official, except they were not officials. Now, to voters already nervous about election security, it hit a major nerve. And now party officials in Orange County are trying to send a new message. Nick, what is their new message?
Yeah, the message from Orange County Republican Party officials is they're really trying to reassure voters that the voting system is safe and secure in Orange County and to not wait until the last minute to vote. They're really noting in recent emails to voters here that there is this huge advantage of Democrats outvoting Republicans so far, almost 2-1. So there's concerns among Republican officials here that President Trump's claims of election fraud could be delaying or suppressing Republican ballots, especially with mail-in voting. So to reassure voters, the Orange County Republican Party sent out an email over the weekend titled "Voting in Orange County is Safe and Secure." They wrote that they were hearing Republican voters are holding on to their ballots to vote in person because they don't trust voting by mail. And the county party chairman, Fred Whitaker, wrote, quote, "I want to assure you that voting by mail or dropping off your ballot in Orange County is safe and secure. The Orange County Registrar of Voters and Neil Kelly has our full confidence that your ballots will be received and counted."
All right. Now, Now, all right, let's drill down now on some of the more competitive races in Orange County. Back in 2018, several seats traditionally held by Republicans flipped to Democrats, and now Republicans are fighting to get them back while Democrats are hoping to keep a hold of them. So, and actually, there's a great voter guide on Voice of OC's website. But let's start with District 39. It's a rematch between Democrat Gil Cisneros and Republican Young Kim to represent an area that covers Fullerton and Yorba Linda. Nick, break down this race and where it could be headed.
Yeah, this is definitely one to watch. It was one of the closest congressional races in the entire country last time in 2018. In fact, in the first few days after the election, Young Kim was ahead and actually went to Washington, D.C. for freshman orientation, only to find out that she lost the seat once more ballots were counted. This time around, Gil Cisneros, the Democrat, is running on an anti-Trump platform. He's advocating for gun reform and protecting undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from being deported. Young Kim is a former assemblywoman and aide to the former Republican congressman in that district, Ed Royce. She has largely avoided talking about the president and is focused on homelessness and jumpstarting the pandemic economy. And she's one of the few local Republican candidates to criticize the president for calling COVID the, quote, China virus.
All right, let's go to District 45. That includes Irvine and Laguna Hills. Democrat Katie Porter holds the seat. She faces Republican Greg Raths. First, Greg Raths. Who is Greg Raths?
Yeah, he's a Mission Viejo city councilman and a former Marine Corps colonel. He says he wants to hold China accountable for the coronavirus pandemic and wants to get all personal protective equipment to be manufactured in the U.S. Unlike Young Kim, Raths has been a big supporter of President Trump on his social media accounts. Porter is in her first term in Congress, and she's gone viral a few times for her grilling of banking and Wall Street executives during hearings in Congress, and she's promising to overturn the Trump tax cuts.
All right, so give us a tale of the tape on this one.
Yeah, so this one's considered a little less competitive with an advantage for Porter. But again, there's no guarantees in politics. So turnout will likely be a major driver of how the ultimate outcome comes down. Porter won by a sizable margin in 2018, and this time she's outraised Raths by about 10-1. But this was one of the more competitive races in the past, so we'll have to see how it all turns out.
All right, last on the list, District 48. That area covers much of the beach cities of Orange County, Huntington Beach, Laguna Beach. Republican Michelle Steele takes on incumbent Democrat Harley Ruta. How do the candidates compare on the issues important to this district?
Yeah, so a lot of insiders consider this to be the most competitive congressional race this time in Orange County, given the tight voter registration in the district and the millions flowing into the race on both sides. On the issues, Ruta is looking to bring back state and local tax deductions that were capped in President Trump's tax reforms. He's also for Obamacare and stronger environmental protection. Steele says she will fight to lower taxes and reopen the economy. She has faced criticism from some Orange County residents for her handling of the coronavirus pandemic. She's the chairwoman of the Orange County Board of Supervisors, and she has earlier on questioned a lot of the science behind masks and repeatedly mischaracterized the coronavirus rates in Orange County to downplay them. She's against sanctuary city policies and says she wants to strengthen border security.
One more thing, Nick, is there any sense that these races might not just hinge on the candidate's individual appeal, but for how Orange County voters feel about the Republican Party led by the president?
Yeah, it's always, you know, a combination of both how voters feel about the candidates and what they think of the party and who's leading the parties nationally. You know, you've got President Trump and Mitch McConnell on the Republican side and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on the Democrat side. Democrats did very well in Orange County in 2018, flipping all four of those Republican-held congressional districts. And we'll have to see which way it goes in November. It's expected to be, again, very close between Ruta and Steele and Cisneros and Kim. And a lot of people kind of see these congressional seats as kind of implementing the agenda of the two national parties. So a lot of people do vote along those party lines.
We're going to have you on speed dial. That's Nick Gerda, reporter for The Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Nick.
Staying with the election, a lot of people are voting by mail for the first time, but military personnel have been doing it since the Civil War. This year, as troops fill out their ballots, some polls suggest their political preferences may be changing. From San Diego, Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
In a year when millions of people are expected to vote by mail, overseas troops were among the first to receive their ballots. Federal law requires that they go out at least 45 days before the election. San Diego County Register of Voters Michael Vu has been getting ready for weeks.
So this is our tabulation room right here. All the mail ballots will be processed and scanned in there.
San Diego County is one of 11 counties in the U.S. that have over 10,000 military and overseas absentee voters. Vu says there has never been a hint of widespread fraud, though not every ballot comes back in time to be counted. Federal law does make it a bit easier for these voters to vote absentee. For instance, overseas military voters are the only California voters who can return their ballots by fax.
In many cases, we don't know what the status of that military and overseas voter is. Could they be potentially on a ship that doesn't necessarily have a good transmission when it comes down to fax?
Even with the extra measures over the last two presidential elections, military personnel actually voted at a lower percentage than other absentee voters, both in San Diego County and nationally. And this election, polls showed this block of voters is more in play than in previous elections. A Military Times poll in August showed Joe Biden with the lead, with President Trump's approval ratings well below what it had been at the start of his term. Ed Yokley is a senior reporter with Morning Consult, which has been tracking military and veteran households.
And military families are not unlike the rest of the electorate. I mean, we're seeing Joe Biden do better with older folks and with white folks and with men across the board.
This group has typically been a reliable part of the Republican base, and in some ways it still is. Morning Consult polled veterans and active duty households after a bombshell article in The Atlantic reported the president had called people who serve losers and suckers. Morning Consult found support for the president holding steady. He was still leading among military and veteran households.
I think we've seen with white voters and with men who are sort of the Trump base, not a whole lot has moved their views across the board over the last 4 years.
One thing that did hurt the president in the polls was his talk of sending the military to quell civil unrest or to monitor the elections. Back from Walter Reed Medical Center after being diagnosed with COVID-19, Trump tweeted a video message to military voters.
We got everybody pay increases, three of them. There's never seen anything like what I've done for the military.
For most candidates, it's hard to target military voters directly. Regulations make it difficult to hold events on base. Democrat Doug Applegate, a retired Marine, ran for Congress in 2016 and 2018. The district includes the sprawling Camp Pendleton in Southern California, where more than 36,000 people live on base.
I wouldn't go on base. I was asked that on occasion, and I thought that that regulation was well-founded, because I don't think that the military needs to be sucked into politics.
They may not even vote where they're based, making it even harder to target them, says Applegate, who didn't win a seat in Congress in two tries. He said these voters tend to be conservative, but not always. And though they may be insulated from the job market,
I think they look at the economy just like everybody else. Is it good? Because active duty military still buy homes. They still live in the community where they're stationed at.
Applegate says national security is also important to military voters. They tend to size up who will do the best job of being their commander-in-chief. In San Diego, I'm Steve Walsh.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. All right, there are three types of tests for COVID-19. There's the molecular test, then there's the antigen test, also known as the rapid test, the one with a quick turnaround, and also the antibody test or the blood test. Now, wouldn't it be a little less stressful and a lot more adorable if a Labrador Retriever could just smell you instead? We'll speak to the U.S. Army researchers who are training dogs to sniff out COVID-19. They're next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Flash flood warnings across Coachella Valley.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm Erin Stone, the climate emergency reporter at LAist.
Desalination really should be considered as a last resort.
I bring you the information and connections you need to understand, cope with, and prepare for the changes caused by the climate emergency.
Potential for what's called landspouts, which are basically like mini tornadoes.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
as much as I love for you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. There are a lot of cool things dogs can do. Some play fetch, others can detect bombs, and some can even sniff out large sums of cash. For years, canines have worked on the front lines of public safety and security, armed with their uniquely strong weapon. That's their sense of smell. Yeah, the nose really knows, especially for dogs. Now, a group of military researchers are trying to teach dogs some new tricks, how to sniff out COVID-19. Here to talk about their groundbreaking research and what it could mean in this pandemic world, I'm joined by Jenna Gadberry and Dr. Patricia Buckley with the U.S. Army's Combat Capabilities Development Command Chemical Biological Center. Now, I'm wondering so much, because when I heard about this story, my mind started to race all around. Where did this idea to train dogs to detect disease come from? Did you just wake up one morning while quarantined and said, wouldn't it be cool if dogs could do this? Or was it something you were already working on and then COVID acted as a catalyst?
Well, we actually have had dogs detecting different diseases and for quite some time. We have a whole community of medical detection dogs that are able to find different cancers, are able to determine whether or not an individual is about to have a seizure, and a whole slew of different medical, issues that people could have. These dogs are able to sense that there is a physiological change in that person, and they are alerting on that change, the metabolites that are coming off of that person. So we took that medical detection dog concept and are applying it now to identifying a COVID-19 positive patient.
One thing, though, cancer is not contagious the way COVID is. So, Tricia, how does that complicate this kind of work?
Well, one of the things we've been able to do is utilize a containment package that we had designed for another project. It is called the TAD. This TAD is used to put in the odor that you're looking for. You can put that sample inside a container that has a closed lid, and there's a membrane that allows the odor to come through so that whatever you're putting inside there is not exposed to anything. So the dogs, when they smell, they're just smelling the odors coming off of it, and there's no actual exposure to whatever the sample is, in this case, the virus.
Oh, yeah. Well, because we've heard of a couple of dogs winding up with COVID-19. So I was also wondering, how in danger were the dogs trying to do this kind of work and research?
As Tricia stated, the TAD is a primary containment device. So we have been putting our clinical samples, so up until now it has been urine and saliva, inside the TAD, and it's allowing for the volatile or organic compounds, otherwise known as VOCs, to come out of the sample, but it's keeping both the dogs and the handlers safe from the virus leaving the TAD.
Tricia, so break down exactly what you're researching. Are we talking about dogs sniffing out symptoms, antibodies? How does that part work?
Really, what we're doing is we're trying to train the dogs on the metabolites that are coming off of infected patients. And so, like Jenna said, we started with saliva and urine. And what we're hoping is that the dogs can notice a difference in the metabolites or the smell. Jenna often refers to this as a stink bomb coming off of the sample. If you think about your child when they go to the doctor, if they have strep throat, a lot of times you can smell their breath and you know that something is wrong. And then you take them to the doctor and they tell you that, yes, they have strep throat. It's the same concept. What the dogs are doing is smelling out the metabolites that are different that have been produced by this infection.
When it comes to training the dogs, how do you do that? Just the same way you train them to either, you know, sit down or roll over, where you give them a positive reinforcement? How does that part work?
All of our training is positive reinforcement based, because this odor has such a low headspace. And so for the layman, what that means is we can't smell it. And it is at such a low concentration that we've had to train these dogs to really dig in. It's like finding that needle in a haystack. We take them through a whole process. Since this is what we would call more or less a biological threat, we know that it's going to not be as easy to find as, say, a stick of C4, where there's a lot of odor coming off of the C4. This is not as easy to find.
And you mentioned, Tad, the training aid delivery device. What does that look like? What are we talking about there?
So the TAD, the one that we are actually using right now in this study, is a 4-ounce glass jar. We refer to it as having a business end that has a filter and a grid on it. And that filter is a specific pore size. So it'll allow the odors to come out, but it keeps the virus inside the glass jar.
So what stage are you in the research? Can we expect to see these dogs at local airports and maybe even stadiums soon, Jenna?
So as discussed earlier, we have been training the dogs and testing the dogs on saliva and urine, but our end goal is to have a standoff detection capability. So what that means is we will be able to take the dogs past people and not have to have the dog right up on them. There is a no touch factor at all, or maybe they're touching a piece of gauze and we give the gauze to the dogs. So we are transitioning the dogs right now to what we call as the sweat portion of the study. And we are actually looking for COVID-19 positive patients to wear t-shirts for 24 hours. We're working with our collaborator at University of Pennsylvania. The t-shirts are being sent there and we're packaging them. And now we're training the dogs on sweat.
Considering how much, regrettably, coronavirus is a part of our lives, and we never know when a vaccine will become available for everyone to use, is there any chance that these dogs would be available if someone wanted to have them at home or maybe have them in a place where a lot of people show up at, so that way that they can feel safe from COVID-19?
Well, how we're using it right now for Department of Defense applications is just that. It could be a potential for, say, West Point graduation. We need to go through and actually test a large slew of people. You can't really go through PCR test every single one of the thousands of people that may attend that event. But if we could use the dogs as a tool to start whittling down that 1,000 people down to maybe 40 or 50 that need to go through a secondary screening, then you've eliminated not just a lot of reagent resources and personnel resources, but you've quickly gone through and triaged a large group of folks. So you're hitting it on the head. Could it be something that we could use for standoffs, say maybe for schools, to be able to quickly allow our kids back into schools or at airports or any large event, NFL, MLB? This is going to be an open source report that is published through UPenn. So we don't plan to hide anything, and we already know that we have a lot of international partners. The Finnish just came out with their program, Dubai, where they have already employed such a detection capability in their airports.
That's Jenna Gadbury and Dr. Patricia Buckley with the U.S. Army's Combat Capabilities Development Command Chemical Biological Center. All right, so the Dodgers are back in the World Series, third time in the last 4 years. I know you've had your heart broken many, many times by the Dodgers, but this time someone says that things are different, that it won't be like it was a few years ago. We'll hear that argument. Well, I'm a Dodger pessimist. You know what I might think of that argument, but we'll hear it coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidi, it's an Eagle Rock amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shells and kicked in my face, but I come through.
I need to go on.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Yeah, it was a nail biter from start to finish, but with one swing of the bat, the Dodgers punched their World Series ticket.
This time he hits the ball to deep right field. Cody Bellinger has done it! And the Dodgers lead in Game 7!
Cody Bellinger's big blast in the seventh capped a comeback to win last night's Game 7 and the National League Championship Series. The Dodgers really had been pushed to the brink of elimination by the Atlanta Braves and had to win three in a row to get back to the World Series. Now, it's the first time a team has made it to the World Series 3 out of 4 years since the Yankees did it from 2000 to 2003. Now, the difference? Well, the Yankees actually brought home a title one of those years. For the Dodgers, the jury is still out, although manager Dave Roberts thinks otherwise.
This year is our year. This is our year.
We'll see. Molly Knight is senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA and author of the book, The Best Team Money Can Buy. Molly, now your piece today in The Athletic is titled, Dodger Fans, the Championship Wait Might Be Over Because This Team is Different. Molly, we've been down this road before. How is this year different?
We've been down this road so many times. I'm sick of being in a car. Yes, I recognize that. And obviously, Dodger fans understand when you lose 7 years in a row in excruciating fashion to end the season, it can be a little bit traumatic watching these games, like waiting for the other shoe to drop. But I got to tell you, when this team went down 3-1 and they were even losing in game 5, I believe, up until the third inning. Yeah. And I thought to myself, God, where is the leadership that we saw all year, that we saw when Mookie Betts decided he wasn't going to play because he was going to sit out and protest the police brutality and racial injustice that a lot of the NBA teams were doing, and the entire team voted unanimously to sit with him rather than take the field without him. I just thought, where is this close-knit tight team with great leadership? Where is this team? Are they just going to flame out like nothing? And then they came back. Yeah. I mean, they did not get rattled. They did not seem nervous. We've never seen them overcome that kind of adversity during this run. We've seen them get punched in the mouth. But we haven't seen them come back. I mean, coming back from 2-0 and then 3-1, it just shows a kind of spirit and resolve that they've lacked in the past. And I think this is their year.
Molly, you should know that I am a Dodger pessimist.
I understand.
I was born and raised here, but baseball is one of those games where failure is the main part of it. You have to embrace failure. Now, looking at the matchup between the Dodgers and Rays, and by the way, I was impressed by their comeback. It was a very good comeback. Which team do you think benefits the most from the bizarre circumstances of this year's postseason? No team is in their home ballpark, barely anyone in the stands.
Yeah, that's a great question. The Rays are a really good team. These are the two best teams in baseball who were left. I mean, I think people picked the Dodgers. Everyone picked the Dodgers to win the NLCS over the Braves, but man, the Braves gave them all they could handle. They were also a really, really good team. And I got to say, last night it felt it was kind of crazy to hear how loud those Dodger fans got. There were only 10,000 people allowed in that stadium, and you figure a lot of them are probably just neutral observers who live in Dallas who love baseball. And there had to have been at least some Braves fans. Texas, Dallas isn't that far from Atlanta. They got loud. I think if this game is, I mean, if these World Series games are truly just made up of the crowd, truly just made up of Rays fans and Dodger fans, unfortunately for the Rays, that's going to be about 98-2. Just because of the sheer number of fans. The Rays have one of the smallest fan bases in the sport because they're one of the newer teams, and they have a horrible stadium. And I know they have some proud fans, Dick Vitale being a diehard, dyed-in-the-wool Rays fan.
That's right, yeah.
But I mean, if you believe that the crowd will give a team a boost, the Dodgers will get that boost. Now, the Rays also, though, have an advantage getting 2 days off before the World Series starts. Yeah. That gives them a better chance to line up their pitching. So that could potentially be huge. I think these teams are pretty evenly matched. So it'll be really they've got the best bullpen, a stable of guys who throw 98-99, and the Dodgers have the explosive offense. So it's really going to be, an incredible World Series.
talking to Molly Knight, senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA. Since you brought up pitching, Molly, looking at the matchup, tomorrow, game one, you mentioned well-rested Rays. They're starting Tyler Glasnow. He's from Hart High in Santa Clarita. The Dodgers are starting Clayton Kershaw and his whopping 5.40 World Series ERA. Molly, when should the Dodgers relief pitcher start warming up? Right now, in an hour, tomorrow morning?
Let's just take a breath. So the thing about the Rays is this is sort of an ideal matchup for Kershaw. I mean, we saw how he handled the Brewers in the first round, and they didn't have a whole lot of offense outside of Christian Yelich, who was having a down year. The Rays have Randy Arozarena, who has been the best hitter outside of Corey Seager in the playoffs by far. So he's very dangerous, but they don't have a lot of offense outside of that. I mean, they're really going to rely on their pitching and their defense to win. And pitching and defense do win championships. So they're not, again, they're not an easy opponent by any stretch. But I like this matchup for Kershaw, to be honest with you. I think if he can avoid getting crushed by Arozarena, if they could pitch around him a little bit, I think he's going to have a great start. And let's not forget that part of that World Series ERA has to do with what happened in Houston in game five of the 2017.
That's the past. I don't remember that.
Yeah, I was there. They didn't swing and miss one pitch. We know why. So hopefully this is a great opportunity for him to find redemption and end that tired narrative that we're all sick of, or at least I am.
One more thing, Molly. One more thing really quick. Yeah. So, okay, winning the World Series would really be the only way the Dodgers live up to the title in your piece, Molly. But if they don't and fall short for the third time in four seasons, what are we to make of this generation of Dodgers?
I think this is a tough year. We didn't really see teams at the deadline because the trading deadline was so weird. We didn't really see teams going out and adding those final pieces because they couldn't see, the scouting was so limited and teams were so freaked out by the expanded playoff format that we were worried that it was going to wind up being some random team below 500, like, say, the Astros making it to the World Series, and they almost did. But we've really got the two best teams in baseball left. So if the Dodgers lose, obviously it'll be disappointing for Dodger fans and they'll feel cursed. But there's not going to be a whole lot of shame in losing to the Rays. If it's a well-played series, it's just going to be back to the drawing board again next year. But I think they've got the pieces. They're poised for the long haul to keep doing this. And sooner or later, God help us, they will finally win. I think this is going to be the year. I really, really, really think it's going to be the year. Gosh, fingers crossed. And, and if it's not there, if it's not the year, then, it's a pandemic, shortened season, doesn't count.
Doesn't count. All right. Molly Knight is senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA, author of the book, The Best Team Money Can Buy. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, you can always find us all over social media. We're on Twitter at Take2. I'm there as well at AMartinezLA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.